So welcome to another episode of the 21CB Thing. My name is Tara Palata and I'm joined by...
Damasara.
Yes, fantastic. So
third episode. What's the plan, Tara Palata?
The plan. It's your plan.
It's my plan.
Your plan is to read little quotes then talk about them.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so your initial plan was that we both had a theme where we find quotes and then talk about them. But I misunderstood you as to mean we just find quotes. So I've got random quotes and you've got quotes about meditation.
Yeah, but that's fine. Doesn't matter. No, I have other quotes as well. It's fine.
All say, it's
just quotes about just Buddhism, about what does it mean to live a Buddhist, lead a Buddhist lifestyle.
In the 21st century.
That's what this podcast is about.
That's
if you haven't figured that out yet.
That's what all this is about, isn't it? That's what all of this is about.
Okay, well,
yeah.
Tara Palata. Your first quote.
My first quote.
What is it about? Whom is it by?
Okay, well, my first quote is by Sangharakshita, who is the founder of this order and movement, the Tree Ratna order and movement, yeah.
That's correct,
okay,
yes.
So I'm going to read something from a little book of aphorisms called Peace is a Fire, yeah? And it's from the section on arts. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay, here we
go. Very good.
So
we like the arts, don't we?
We do like the arts. The myth of Perseus and Medusa. He could cut off her head only by looking at it not directly, which would have petrified him, but indirectly, at the reflection in his shield. Similarly, we cannot confront reality, especially our own psychic reality, directly. It would kill us. Art, etc., is the medium. So I don't know if you know that. I'm assuming most people know that myth of Perseus and Medusa. It's a Greek myth where you have Medusa. She's amazing. Her head's full of snakes, isn't she? And when she looks at somebody, she turns them to stone.
Yeah.
So the myth is Perseus turns up with his sword and his shield, and he has to cut her head off, but he has to look at her through his shield indirectly. So Bhante Sangharakshita is saying it's similar with the nature of reality. So if we looked at the nature of reality, it would kill us, which is why art is the medium to look through into the nature of reality. It's like our shield, our reflection of reality that we indirectly look at, and then we come closer towards reality.
That's true, isn't it? Because art is... There's something about art being a kind of window into meaning or something. I don't know. I haven't quite figured it out in my head yet, but it's, you know, sometimes we try to understand art as an expression of our emotions or something, and maybe it is, but I think sort of classical art is kind of, is trying to highlight reality in a way. It's trying to make us more receptive to reality or something. I don't know if you just kind of look at religious art, for example, is trying to say, well, look, it is as if there's, I don't know, angels are as if men had wings, you know. It's not literally how an angel looks like, but it's like, if you imagine that, you're coming quite close to that experience of divinity or something.
But that's quite interesting, isn't it, that this whole business of not being able to look at reality directly, that you need... I mean, you'd assume that you'd want to look at it directly, which we do, don't we? I mean, that's the whole point of Buddhism. We want to get to the stage where we can experience reality directly, but that's not always possible. It reminds me, I had a friend of mine who I was living with in a community years ago, and he started doing this lucid dreaming stuff, and he met a Buddha in his dream, and he said, oh, yeah. And I mean, he said apparently he went up to this Buddha in his dream and said, show me the nature of reality, which is a big ask. And he just woke up screaming.
I can imagine.
He didn't look at it indirectly.
Well, I think that in many religions you have that. If you kind of, I mean, we would call it reality, I guess, another... You know, and like in Christianity, you would have, like, if you look at God directly, even have it, you know, talking about Greek myths, you know, they have that view that if you would see a God in its pure form, you wouldn't be capable of of bearing that, like you would die. So so I think Zeus has killed a few people by just appearing in his natural form. So they always come closer to looking a bit more human, so that they can communicate to other human beings. So there seems to be something going on with, like, as if your mind isn't ready to take it yet. I think it's similar in Buddhist practice, isn't it? Like we have different stages we go through to prepare the mind to actually be able to kind of get into some sort of contact with something transcendental.
I had that recently. Two things. One, a very strong sense that actually I do need, in Buddhism, what's been translated into insight. I do need insight. It's not good enough just to be in good states of mind. Because when your conditions change, then your whole world changes. But it's said, isn't it, that with insight or wisdom, from a Buddhist perspective, I wouldn't say you're invulnerable. Are you invulnerable? I don't know. Is that the wrong word? It doesn't.
Something like
it won't
that.
Destroy you. It won't. You're above it, beyond it.
Yeah, you're not. But then pushed away by it.
Then immediately after that, I thought, well, actually, I've in order to have that insight, you can't just drop. You can't just have it. You can't grab insight and kind of make it happen, can you? As much as you'd like to do all the classic Buddhist reflections, you know, everything's impermanent, insubstantial, blah blah blah. Actually, unless the soil is prepared, it's not. It just bounces off. So I thought, oh, I need to do a lot of stuff. My creaky chair. I need to do a lot of stuff. I need to prepare the soil.
Just as a follow up, though, would you like to tell the story of your dream that you had with the Buddha?
That was great. Yeah, I will. I will say that.
So I had, because it's related to that, isn't it? Is. Because you had that insight in the dream already.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, and that was recent, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I was having this dream, and I was probably somewhere in London, and I was with this gang, right? And this guy stole my jacket. Yeah. So I was really annoyed. So I was running after this guy to get my jacket back, and I ended up in this really dodgy place, trying to find this guy. There's a few of them. And then I suddenly realized I was dreaming. And I was like, wow, this is a lucid dream. Yeah. What should I do? And then I remembered Sangharakshita's advice about looking for a Buddha and getting a teaching. Yeah. So I walked along, and then there was a hole in the floor. Yeah. And I saw this little wooden Buddha. I thought, that's a start. Yeah. So I went down into the hole. Actually, before that, I did think to myself, the key point to this, which is why you asked me, before I went into the hole, I said, I'm going to go and find a Buddha. And I said, no, don't go and look for a Buddha. Look for a deva, in Buddhism, like a god or goddess. A friendly, benevolent.
Like an angel or something.
An angel, friendly. Like benevolent spirit, because I instinctively felt in that dream, I'm not capable of talking to a Buddha, and it would just destroy me, and it wouldn't, it's too much for me right now. I just need a nice presence in my life, I need a nice, friendly little presence that's going to be nice to me and love me and all this, and it's going to be fun, it's going to be nice. Anyway, so I saw this little wooden Buddha, and I thought, and I went down there. And it was really lovely, actually. So I looked at this little wooden Buddha, and it just turned its head slowly to the left and just started talking to me and held its arms out to me. I was like, And it was so kind. It was just pure love, but it was fantastic. There's a whole rest of the dream, which I won't go into, because it's probably too personal and not in an exciting way, but just boring. But just this, and then after that dream, what was quite interesting was I thought, that little wooden Buddha, it didn't have all the bells and whistles, and it wasn't like, Buddha time, Buddha coming out of the sky and here's the real deal.
That's kind of what we're expecting, isn't it?
Yeah, it was like this little wooden Buddha. And it was only after the dream where I thought, that kind of was a Buddha, because I almost felt like crying in the dream. It was so beautiful, so much love, just pure love, and kindness, and even fearlessness, and I thought, that's interesting that I asked to meet a friendly, benevolent spirit, you could say, rather than a Buddha, and ended up meeting something more like a Buddha, you know? So that indirect, yeah, maybe it relates. It's the indirect. I didn't want to see reality itself. I just wanted a nice, friendly presence to look after me a bit.
Yeah.
And ended up with this beautiful contact.
Yeah, yeah. That reminds me of, I think I've mentioned it here on this podcast already, that, well, my main motivation to get into Buddhism was actually the ritual, and the more religious side of it. And, you know, we have briefly talked about it, but we have, there are practices like visualization practices in Buddhism, and we, as order members, we do them every day. So we visualize a figure, but I remember I was so keen on that, that I would sort of go Buddha hunting, in meditation. And like on retreat, for example. And, you know, when I wasn't sure which figure to take, I'd be like, okay, I need to have a vision now. And I would kind of really try to make it happen. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. And I remember on a long retreat, I think it was actually my ordination retreat where I got ordained. I just had this habit of trying to, even unconsciously, hunt for the Buddha, you know, be like, okay, I want to see you. I want to see the figure. And I can't quite remember what I did, but I remember having this experience of just meditating and doing my visualization practice and trying to be really open and receptive to whatever comes up. But then I felt this force coming into my consciousness from outside. This is how I felt like. I had no idea what was actually happening.
Yeah.
But sort of I located it from sort of below left, here, it sort of came in. At the time, the only word I had for it was ancient force. That's how it felt like, a sort of really ancient force. And I was so scared. And I was like, okay, no, you shouldn't try to hunt for reality, because it was really scary. And it wasn't a dream. It was my meditation, just sitting on a cushion. At first you're like, great, I'm having an experience, you know, like you're happy. But then it's actually really terrifying. And then you're like, sure, why was I so naive to think I could just reach out for something so profound? And so I don't even know whether it was a Buddha or not, or nothing. It could even be, you know, because you're kind of in that mindset of hunting, it could even have been a non-benevolent force. You know, you never know what you're kind of inviting when you're trying to look at reality. So, that really taught me a lesson that I needed to. So now I just do preparation a lot, and just body awareness, and because that's how you need to prepare your mind if you want to look out for these.
Oh, that's curious.
Yeah.
So why not look at reality directly then? What might we encounter then? I mean, these are just words, obviously, and you know, the Dharma in the higher sense is in enlightenment. Well, which is a direct knowledge of reality. You can't put it into words. There's an actual special Sanskrit word which I've forgotten, which means, is it not a talk of whatever it is anyway? Forget it.
I don't know.
But you can't put it into words, obviously, because you're immediately polarizing this and that duality. And at the same time, what exactly would we see that would destroy us as we currently are, unprepared, wandering around through the world?
I think. Well, first of all, I just think that it's so beyond our current way of thinking, and so beyond our current way our mind is structured. So I think you kind of need to prepare your mind well if you're doing these so-called insight practices, Vipassana practices. We're trying to look at reality. What is it? Well, I think you can only talk in metaphor here. And like, you know, what is so beautiful, like sometimes beauty is described as something that's actually terrifying. I think there's this famous Japanese figure, Yukio Mishima. He was a filmmaker, but also, no, was he a filmmaker? He's definitely an author, but also a slightly controversial figure.
Yeah.
And he said, beauty is that which, what was it, that overpowers, overwhelms, and destroys, or something.
Oof.
He had quite a sort of, like, he was very into aesthetics and beauty, but in very kind of strong beauty, like very almost morbid kind of terrifying beauty. So he had a sort of vision for real. I mean, he committed suicide after he he did a whole staged how do you call it, like he was taking over, I think, some ministry of war or something. And then I think it was in the 70s.
Was he like dressed in red with these gold buttons?
I think he might have he kind of sort of staged a takeover.
Oh, it's him.
And then he committed suicide on the balcony, and there was a whole for him it was an act of art. Yeah. Wow. But yeah, he said that he also wrote novels and stuff, and I think even plays or something, I can't remember, but yeah, he was very into that. But I think he's a good example of someone who had a deep vision of beauty and reality, but did not have the integration and what we would call positive emotion to kind of hold the reality of of beauty. I think it destroyed him because he was searching, looking out for it.
That's wild. That's wild.
Yeah, so I think there's something to that, the powerful force of beauty.
It's an important, you know, funny enough, talking about that, I think that's quite good, actually, this whole almost terrifying nature of beauty. Being, you could maybe, because, what did they say, like, shubha, this word shubha?
Ah, shubha, yeah.
It's said to be, or, you know, it's part of reality, isn't it? What am I saying? What I was going to say, in a way, was it's quite good to have that in mind, this sense of beauty being terrifying, because I think it also changes the way we relate to the Buddha himself, and also even all the other figures in the Mahayana. They're not just they're not comfy, cozy figures, are they? You see them, and I mean, just speaking personally, any time that I've had a sense, whether it's a glimpse of a glimpse of a glimpse, as they say. Of a Buddha, or even just what you might call an angel in a way, there's been some kind of, I wouldn't say ferocity, but there's some power and force that isn't just, slightly contradicts what I was saying before about this little Buddha being just pure love. And that's an aspect, isn't it? But also,
it's an aspect,
one has, you know, there's this sense, isn't there, like with, even with something beautiful, that if it's truly beautiful, it will really...
Yeah.
Like with reality, it will show you something that, like you were saying, your mind, we're just normally not in this world. No. We're on a kind of utilitarian, structured.
Yeah. You're not aware of what lurks in the depths as well.
Yeah, and then you see it, and it's like a monster. It can be maybe monstrous.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, like reality. Woof.
I think you can only appreciate real beauty if you have an idea of what your mind is capable of in the negative, you know. I think you can only appreciate real art and real beauty if you're actually aware of the heights and lows of human existence and yourself. I think that's one of the problems that we have if we are kind of numbed down all the time by input and by just sort of normal mundane images. Because then if you're just running after excitement, well, obviously a painting won't strike us as very exciting. You know, I mean, even though I love classical music, I would get bored by it really easily because I didn't allow myself to actually try to listen to the actual meaning and to the actual message of it. But I think once you're actually starting to get to know the riches of your mind, both in the depths and in the heights, then you will, you'll appreciate beauty more, art more, also get more sense of, there's something being communicated on a different level here. That is so intrinsic to human existence.
It's to do with honesty then as well, isn't
honesty,
it?
Honesty, authenticity.
Because in a way, like, reality is honesty as well, isn't it? It's something more direct. And if you're honest with yourself, then you'll come across parts of yourself that are frankly monstrous.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what we were talking about this last time. I can't remember, but all the mythological side of things is really important, isn't it? To have stories that depersonalize it in a way. It's not just you. You're not inherently evil because you have kind of evil fantasy.
Yeah.
I've got my little story. You know, it's like a bigger picture. How did I know I was going to tell this little story? That's weird.
Yeah.
But anyway, no, I was just thinking, but you know, when on my first long meditation retreat. Well, long, 2 weeks. Long, it was long for me. It's long enough.
Long enough.
Yeah, long enough. And it was just meditation. My friend Paramananda invited me, and I thought, oh, okay. So I went along, and it was going swimmingly for about 7 days. I was like, oh, now I'm in the bliss and all this stuff. And then the one sit, it was in the morning. There was this woman in front of me. Okay. And then there was a guy next to me. And I was just perfectly minding my own business, just meditating. All of a sudden, I just got this insane urge. And obviously wasn't going to act on it. I just wanted to jump on her and kick her brains out, basically. It was wild. It was really intense.
Oh, yeah.
And then I turned to the guy. I had the guy next to me. And all of a sudden, I had these like monkey teeth.
Yeah.
And I was just literally ripping his face off in with my teeth.
Yeah.
It so freaked me out. I thought I was a psychopath. Mm-hmm. I really did, yeah. It was like, I thought there's something really wrong with me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I need to some therapy or something. So I went it was in a Buddha field retreat. It was in these tents.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly.
Wild anyway. It was, the surroundings.
But it was great. Okay, so I went into Paramananda's tent. I had a meditation interview. And I said to him, yeah, like in my mind, I was just, I told him all the stuff, what was going on. And he was great. He was just like, it's just called being a bloke, innit? And I was just like, oh.
Yeah.
I'm not a psychopath.
Yeah. No, not more than anyone else is.
Not more than anyone else, hopefully. I mean, I am a psychopath, but everyone is, isn't it?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the kind of emotions you can encounter on a retreat are amazing. I've never encountered those strong emotions on a retreat.
Energy,
like... Mm. But in all directions, it could be, it could manifest in very self-critical, self-doubt. It's so strong on retreat.
Mm.
But also, like you say, intense craving, intense, or even just love for someone. And and then we've kind of termed it retreat love. Like you're like super in love with someone. And then after the retreat is over, you're like, what was I thinking? Like, why was
happen,
I into that
it? You just
person?
Get obsessed with somebody. You're just like, oh, it's the one.
It's the one. And you're just like, I don't know, flowing. And it's like retreat love. And
retreat love.
It's like soulmates and whatnot. And then after the retreat, you're like, meh.
Yeah, sad.
It's just another person. Yeah.
But then also, there's interesting, isn't it? Like you say, it goes in all directions because that's the whole thing about being on a retreat. You get all the difficult stuff. But then also, you find yourself sometimes... bowing to the shrine, not feeling like a fraud.
Oh, yeah.
Feel like you're actually bowing, and it's like the whole of you's bowing. You're like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And you're making an offering, and you really believe it, and it's happening, and you're meditating, and it's really, you don't feel like a fraud.
Yeah.
So
even if you feel like, I'm so full of hatred, I'm so full of craving.
But that's okay.
And then you still bow, and then you're still like, actually, there's a connection there because you're like, why am I like, can't you please help me?
Yeah, but there's a connection then because there's all of you's available.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not just like this little, oh, I need to be a good person bit at the top, which is, all the other stuff makes me bad. It's like, it's vibrancy, isn't it? You've got access to all of it, whether it's this like savage monkey or it's some angelic thing. It feels amazing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you can do any, like you say, then it is still integrated because even if you feel full of hatred and you just want to smash this guy's head and you like some annoying guy is breathing too loud next to you in the shrine room or something, even that, it's still in a context and you can somehow, it can get transformed in the just by having all of these sides of you available to yourself.
On that note,
around
craving and hatred.
Tell us, speak it.
What?
Speak it. Come
speak
on.
The word.
Speak
preach.
The word. Preach, brother. Preach. Tell us about craving.
It's, I had a, because I was in like some interreligious stuff recently, Zoom meeting.
Good, well.
And we had been talking about creation, about like how the world was created.
Mm.
And so many of the
what
religions that were present Well, obviously they kind of believe in that some sort of god or divinity kind of formed the earth and created the world, and created human beings.
Mm.
And I always had to say, well, no, sorry, we can't, like, this is not our common ground here. This is like Buddhism.
Mm.
So I was kind of thinking, okay, what does Buddhism say about that? And, well, I mean, in a sense, the Buddha does say, well, just don't bother about it. Like, don't worry about it, how the world was created.
Yeah.
But then from a different angle, maybe a bit more metaphorical, but that's something that interests me, is that the vision of creation in Buddhism. Now,
do I need, is this a warning? Warning moment.
This is a warning moment.
Everyone needs to sit down.
Buckle up.
Calm down.
Yeah, calm down.
All right.
Sit down.
Oh, God, what are you going to say now?
The world is created by ignorance, craving, and hatred. This is what Buddhism says. This is at the beginning of the cycle. So this is quite great.
It's a very terrible thing to say, Dharma, sorry, what you just said.
But this is the Buddhist...
Ruined my Friday.
But this is... I find that so fascinating.
Yeah.
That this is the view of Buddhism.
Yeah.
That because what it means, what it means is that in craving and hatred is a lot of energy. And...
Okay.
And so it's our kind of, it's our force for life. And if that energy would be released into something more like enlightenment, well, what kind of worlds could we create with that? What kind of Buddha lands could we create with that? That's kind of, so that's why I find that interesting. But it gets us away from this whole view of like, oh, everything's already perfect and there's someone watching over us. That's not the Buddhist vision.
No.
The Buddhist vision is actually, no, not quite, like, there's no god that created all of this,
and ignorance
it's kind of supposed to be perfect, but why is there a lot of war now? No, the Buddhist vision says none of the world as we see it is created by ignorance, and out of ignorance comes hatred and craving. Sorry, that's Buddhism.
What can you
hashtag
do?
Sorry,
it
not sorry. But what that means is, well, see how that, how those forces, powerful as they are, can create something like that. How much more could be created if the mind that is at the root of that is actually one of love, of wisdom, you know. That's the whole point.
That's one thing that I found, I mean, not on a cosmic level, but on a personal level, one thing that I always found really attractive about Buddhism was that whole thing, which I said, I said it then and I'll say it now. But, you know, this whole thing of, all of you's involved, all the demonic stuff, nothing gets left out, all the craving, the hatred. Yeah, you just, it's all there and you transform it. Transforming ignorance into wisdom. It's alchemical. But you got your energy then.
I think
that's the thing. Although, unfortunately, this is very judgmental. I'm very sorry about this in advance. But when you look at a lot of Buddhists, it doesn't seem to be the case. But, you know, they've got their energy and, like, they're really, like, not grey. There's a kind of all of yous, what's the word? Present. That'll do. Good.
Shall we move on to my
quote? Let's move on. Your quote.
I think
we're at the end of my quote.
Probably one quote each.
Yeah.
Good.
Maybe.
Well, mine was about meditation, wasn't it?
Yeah, because you were doing it correctly and I was doing it incorrectly.
Actually, I might choose a different... No, let me just read out this
you
one
choose,
now.
You choose, brother. It's your turn.
It actually fits it quite well now. So let me...
Let's have it.
Let me read it out. So it's actually three verses. Yeah, right. It's from the Dhammapada.
Yeah.
One of the sort of older texts.
Mm.
Not the oldest, but... So it's from the chapter The Mind.
Okay, The Mind.
As a fletcher straightens the arrow... So the man of understanding makes straight the trembling, unsteady mind, which is difficult to guard and difficult to restrain. As a fish threshes from side to side when taken from one abode to another and cast on dry land, so the mind throbs and vibrates with the strain as it abandons the domain of Mara. The mind is frivolous and difficult to control, alighting on whatever it pleases. It is good to tame the mind. A tamed mind brings happiness.
Oof. Oof. That's fantastic. I like that.
It fits in quite well now. It's like, that's what we're trying to do. I mean, we were supposed to talk about meditation, but I think meditation is so central in Buddhism because the Buddha's vision is that the mind is central. Yeah, the mind, our mental states are central. So this is why we talk about craving and about hatred a lot, but also about happiness. Yeah. Those are all mental states.
Yeah. The mind is a power as well, isn't it?
So the mind in Buddhism is the central agent, as it were. Or at least a very powerful one. So what I just love here about is like these three kind of stages of, well, you kind of need to, what does it say? Well, as the fletcher straightens the arrow, so the man of understanding makes straight the trembling, unsteady mind. That's about preparation, isn't it? You prepare.
Yeah.
Which is difficult to guard and difficult to restrain. We've just talked about that. And then the second one I really love is like, the fish one, as a fish threshes from side to side when taken from one abode to another and cast on dry land, so the mind throbs and vibrates with a strain as it abandons the domain of Mara. So Mara is obviously the personification of, well, hatred and evil and ignorance. So the domain of Mara is obviously the unenlightened mind, really, isn't it? So when I read the first verses of this one, like, as a fish, I thought it meant just how the mind is usual in its usual form. But what it's saying is that it's actually quite painful to get out of your habits.
What it
means is like breaking out of habits.
Hard work.
And that needs discipline. And the mind doesn't, you know, initially doesn't want that.
They're an interesting trio though, aren't they? Because the first verse, like you were saying, or the first section that you were reading about a fletcher, like, well, this whole business of straightening an arrow, you could say that, that's like the discipline, isn't it? And it's like the training. You're training your mind in a certain way to be steady and to be calm and whatever. But actually to get out of, in a bigger picture, to get out of this, out of our habits and our delusion, as an image is fantastic, isn't it? It's fish thrashing around on the beach. And frankly, if you practice the Dharma Buddhism for any length of time, you will definitely get periods where you feel like a fish thrashing around on a beach.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, it's wild. Interestingly enough, I think we were talking about this before the podcast as well. You know, there's little the dream that you were talking about earlier, that had an effect on me where I don't want to turn it into something too big, actually, but. Oh dear, I'm doing it now.
Sorry. No.
But anyway, it had an effect on me that really destabilized me, I think. And I don't think it's a bad thing, because anytime I've had, in fact, I trust it, because anytime I've had anything generally of a nature of a higher beauty or reality, whatever you want to call it, it's led from a period of stabilization, you know, stabilizing the mind, like straightening the arrow, however you want to, stabilizing, to a period of destabilization. I mean, you could... Sometimes people talk about, we talk about spiritual death, don't we? And spiritual rebirth. That's quite an extreme word to use. And I was thinking, well, not a softer word, but something a little bit more day to day sometimes. It can be. And for me, it is about destabilization. I get a certain field of stability. I'm meditating, you know, body like mountain. I'm a Buddhist now, and I'm feeling good. And then you get something happens because of that, and because of practice and whatnot, and then it kind of knocks you, because all the ground is gone, you know, so you're thrashing around. That image is super powerful, but if you're going to practice Buddhism, you need to take images like that on, actually, because you've got to know what you're signing up for here. You're not just signing up for a nice time, do you know what I mean? A fish thrashing around on a beach, that doesn't sound so fun.
No.
I don't want that.
That's your mind, because, I mean, what we're trying to do is obviously, you know, we talk about the ego a lot and, you know, about like, well, as you say, destabilizing. It's like, you don't have to bother. Like, sometimes people are so bothered about, how do I get inside? How can I get rid of my ego? Don't worry about that. It's going to happen anyway. Like, if you're just following through, if you're just meditating and kind of facing yourself, you know, coming back to the directly facing.
It will happen, huh?
it'll, you know, some, I guess sometimes people do need a bit of a push in a direction or something, but I think generally if you're, if you are with people who are really practicing, if you just do your practices,
well, study is good for that.
Steadily studying.
Maybe that's a new word. Steadily studying.
Yeah.
Steadily. So if you're doing some steadily.
Yeah. Then, could be an app, couldn't it?
Yeah. Steadily. But I was thinking, no, like you were saying, because sometimes it's not even necessary to do quote-unquote insight practices. If you're really living a certain life and you're meditating and you're really enjoying your meditation, even as bliss, wow, great.
Yeah.
Then you study and you read, well, what did the Buddha say about all this and its point, place in it? Naturally, your mind will have some kind of clarity and depth.
Yeah.
And color and energy. And then you reading the Dharma,
yeah,
it has an effect.
Yeah.
You don't need necessarily even to do anything. You just practice in that way. That is insight, reading what the Buddha has to say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Studying, reflecting upon
precise.
It, talking about it, you know. And you don't need to look out for destabilization too much, I don't think.
No.
I think it just kind of, it just knocks you off.
It will just prematurely. Happen. There's not much you can do about it.
It knocks you off prematurely because life happens to you anyhow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Like people die, people, you know, you will lose stuff. And exactly. It's good to keep. I mean, there's the other extreme of people just kind of going into dream mode every time they meditate and not really facing anything.
Yeah, well, that's not Buddhism, is it?
Yeah, that's also not the right approach. Like, it's good to have the edge present there in meditation.
But I think it's to do with the intensity as well, isn't it? If you're really, regardless of what practice you're doing, almost, that's why all these kind of disputes between Buddhists are laughable, I think, because at the end of the day, it's like. Regardless of which practice you're doing, actually, if you're doing it with intensity, something's going to happen.
Yeah.
Something quite important, profound will happen, regardless what practice you're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
They're all kind of interchangeable. That's not quite right, but, you know.
But also, I like that image, of the fish, not just for, like, meditation, but for the sort of the spiritual life in general. It's like when you... I really noticed that when I figured out that I'm Buddhist, my second coming out, so to speak, it was very great. But you start to, and I know that from some people who are here, like who also, who are quite new or kind of getting more into Buddhism, you feel like you're moving away from a certain identity you've had and of a certain idea of how your life should look like.
Yeah.
And it feels like you're just kind of raw all the time. You just feel like you're super sensitive. Totally. You haven't fully sort of taken on the faith or what we call the going for refuge isn't kind of that strong enough yet. Yeah. But you've already started to kind of say, well, actually, the kind of securities I have been looking out for in my life aren't really what I want to, where I want to put my life in, like my job or my... You know, it's still good to do those things, but kind of your identification with certain things starts to drop.
Yeah.
And you're kind of seeing more of what life could be like, you know, more life of creativity, of kind of religion, really.
Mm. Yeah. I think the this good point, really, the fish thrashing on the beach isn't, it's not just to do the meditation, is it? It is to do with your whole life and your personality as well, your career, the whole thing. Speaking personally, it's been a... If you could use that term, it's been a I don't know about a flip flop, but it's been a kind of thrashing about. From one minute it's like, I'm Buddhist, I'm doing. Next minute it's like, I can't practice Buddhism. Who am I to think I'm a Buddhist?
A Buddhist, like,
forget about Jesus. It. So then I'll just plunge myself back into some other kind of life, and then it's like, well, this is empty. I can't do this, and I'm back on the Buddhism.
Yeah.
In a way, it's this whole business of getting yourself together, isn't it? It probably just takes time. If it's still going on, then it just eventually there's a sort of synthesis, isn't there? But then what's interesting is there was a really a good friend of mine. I was talking about this to him years ago, and a good friend, he said, there's a really good quote from Sangharakshita, which was, beware of premature synthesis. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you don't just try and make it all nice straight away
mm-hmm.
and say, oh, well, I'm a Buddhist, I meditate, mm-hmm. but I'm also doing this and that's fine and it's all working and I'm one unified person. It's more like the struggle will come. It's like art, isn't it? It's like this bloody podcast. We've done two takes of this, wanting to jump off a bridge somewhere. And now we're sort of talking normally like humans. It's fine. Yeah. But it's like, I'm not going to equate this to art, but
no.
Okay, forget that. Let's just erase, edit that bit out. But... we won't, but anyway,
high class art, very highbrow, very highbrow.
But it's like art, isn't it? Any creative endeavor, there's a struggle, and you can't get past that. You can't just wish it wasn't there. And it's the same with Buddhism. You can't just wish that it's not going to be difficult and confusing, and one minute you feel like you're a Buddhist and next minute you feel like you're a joke. It's going to happen. It's just, it's all part of it, isn't it? That thrashing is, well, if it's in the Dhammapada, and that's what the Buddha's saying, you need to take it seriously. Yeah,
and it happens again and again. I mean, I just said, well, it's happened. It happened for me when I was kind of first, when I came into Buddhism. Like, well, first I had, when I was new to Buddhism, I had this identity of, oh, I'm going to become like a scientist or something. I was studying biology, and then kind of slowly figuring out, actually, no, this is completely deluded. I'm really not interested in it actually. Oh. But the idea that I'm supposed to be doing this.
Oh.
Was much bigger than, well, how I actually felt about it, you know? Yeah. And then, so that was kind of a struggle, but also, you know, growing up in a non-religious environment, you know, then to kind of take on a more religious identity, I suppose, it was quite painful as well to sort of say, oh, yeah,
it's
quite something these days, isn't it?
I mean, unless, especially, I mean, in any walk of life, because if you've got a previous religion already, then that's a problem, suddenly becoming a Buddhist. But also, if you grew up in a kind of secular, I don't know how you call it, consumerist, I'm not trying to sound clever, but whatever this culture is we live in, I don't even know what it is. Postmodern people call it, I don't know what it means, but...
I have no idea what it is.
Something like that.
Post something.
Post-apocalyptic. No, that's the future.
Modern.
But yeah, so if you kind of grow up in that environment, to suddenly start wanting to identify as a religious person, not that I would say that I do that, but you know, at the same time, you get ordained, you get a name, you know, it's like,
yeah, now do you have to stand for something?
You stand for something, and that changes the environment. I mean, on that note, I remember when I was just after I was ordained, it's quite a thing getting used to a new name, you get given a completely different name, Sanskrit name,
it's pretty spooky.
It's weird. And I was in this marketplace in Norwich, which is in England, with a friend, Padmasagwa, and we got ordained together, and we went to this,
tell us the story.
Anyway, we went to this kind of vegan, there's some new vegan diner place that just opened, in the marketplace. And so I thought, oh, why not, back from ordination. And then I ordered whatever it was, I don't know, some sausage or something. Oh, anyway, and she says, what's your name?
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, Tara Parlata. She looked at me like, what? And I said, Tara Parlata? And she's like, whatever. She shook her head and like wrote my name down, And then Padmasagwa came up. And she's like, all right, love, what do you want? And he said, oh, I'll just have the thing, And she said, okay, what's your name? And he said, Padmasagwa. And she said, oh, come on, what's going on? What are you doing? And I just walked off. I was so embarrassed. But he's super solid. He was cool. He just like burst out laughing. He said, yeah, we're Buddhists, blah, blah, blah. He was quite solid. He just owned it.
Yeah, I could imagine. With him.
I didn't own it. I left. And then she was fine, obviously. But I was like, my Lord, it's like every time I get a coffee now, I just make up a name.
Do you really?
Yeah, straight up. If someone says, oh, what's your name? I go, I was in London.
John.
Yeah. I was with Maitra Bandhu, I think. I was in London. And the woman said...
That's mad.
Yeah. The woman said... she said... I said, yeah, flat white and whatever it was. And she said, what's your name? And I went, John. And Maitra Bandhu looked at me and she looked at me. I was like, that was it. And he was fine. He was like, I think Prime and Bandy's got different names as well.
John
or something. I mean, I just make up names, man.
Oh, dear. No,
not brave enough sometimes. I
can't remember if anything like that happened to me, but... but just sort of to get used to that and then be like, kind of, and then you have to explain yourself, and you have to kind of talk about, you know, what you are. It's quite a big deal.
You stand for a whole world religion all of a sudden.
But what I meant was, I mean, those flapping around kind of feelings There's come up. They come, There's they come again and again.
Exactly.
But they are, I think they are a sign of progress, actually. And it definitely happened with me in my ordination as well. I think like the week before the ordination itself, I was in such a terrible mood, and I really thought I could not be ordained at all. Like, why were they thinking?
Why?
I don't know. Well, I guess it's just, I'm just prone to sort of self-critical thoughts. But I just had these, the funniest story was, I had this, so a friend of mine, he gave me as a present a sort of, like a monk bag, like, you know, in India they have these monk bags. and he was like, you spend 4 months there in the mountains.
What do the monk bags look like? Can you explain to people what they look like?
Very simple kind of shoulder bags made out of cloth.
But
it was blue, and our robes are blue as well, so it fit nicely with the with the robe. And he gave it to me and was like, oh, you can, why don't you take it with you? And I was like, okay, great. And then I think last minute I decided not to take it with me on the journey, because I was like, I never wear a bag on a retreat. Why would I need a bag on a retreat? Because I had my little rucksack anyway for like long walks or stuff. And it's actually not quite handy for a long walk. So I didn't bring it. Immediately regretted it. And then I saw my Trebandu who had a monk bag. And then from then it was over. I woke up in the middle of the night thinking I need to go home because I didn't bring my monk bag. I was like, I cannot be here. This is not the right moment. It's not everything. Nothing is perfect. It needs to be perfect. I need to have my monk bag.
Yeah.
I can't be. Stop everything, guys. Stop everything. God. I need to go home. I need to get ordained next year.
That's wild.
Yeah. But so only a day later, I realized that was actually pretty irrational. But in the moment, you think, your mind actually shows you things, and you think, this is truth now. It can't be. Can't be anywhere else.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because you get like we often think, you know, we've come up with this rational idea, but it's like this, you get a kind of almost a force, like a positive or negative energy, to call it that, a bit vague maybe, and then this idea attaches to it, and you just start making up stories about it, but you get this strong surge of something, and then you get, and then it gets kind of, you get a little story for it and a little rationalization around it. But then, especially when you're on a retreat like that, you get these wild sort of energies surging through you. And like, I can't remember, I'm sure I had all sorts of things that Gushi Loka come in. Well, I did actually.
And then other things. And then I forgot, I wasn't sure, did I give the 20 euro to a friend of mine? And then I was like, I think I didn't. I need to go home now, immediately. It was at the morning of my ordination. I was like, I remembered, I forgot to give her the 20 euro.
Yeah.
I need to go back immediately. I can't be ordained.
That's serious fish flapping on the beach business. That's a very serious, clear example of fish flapping
fish
on the
flapping.
Beach.
But it's good, because it kind of, after I was through that and after I could kind of, I gathered myself and was like, no, okay, this is just your mind turning around. And this is just, you know, every time something significant changes in your life and something opens up, it's about reality, isn't it? Like, because ordination in a way is kind of reality coming a bit closer to you in a way. Not to sound grand, but there's a moment of like a flash of
something goes
reality. Your mind is just like, sign me out. I can't handle this. You know, I can't look at this directly. So it just comes up with all sorts of excuses that it doesn't have to look at it.
Well, maybe I'll do my fish flapping story next week or something, but I had the same thing at ordination. It was insane, man.
Yeah. We need to make a podcast around ordination stories. I think that would be, you could actually come up with some stuff.
from other people's as well.
Oh, yeah. Because it's wild. I mean, because it's one of those moments where you actually have to stand for something. Like, as we said, the name, you know, we get a case, and we're not wearing that all the time, like the little rope thing. But yeah, it's a sort of, it's quite a big deal these days, I think, to actually say, no, I am a religious person, and I'm doing that full time.
Yeah, it is. There's pressure not to.
Yeah.
It's not a fashionable thing, that's for sure.
No. Yeah.
No, it's quite, I think in a way it relates a bit to the, you know, the story of the Buddha's life story. You know, this whole thing of like, what right do you have to get ordained in a way? Who are you?
Who are you?
I mean, it's not the same thing at all, but in terms of an initiation or even even calling yourself a Buddhist, actually. Mm. Yeah, I mean, some people call themselves Buddhist pretty easily, but actually being called, it's like, well, who are you?
Mm.
So you do, you have to kind of own something, don't you?
Yeah, yeah, you have to live up to it in a way, yeah.
What time are we on?
We are, yeah, we can have another little story.
Another quote?
Another quote? Yeah, come on.
Let's have another quote.
Have another quote. One to finish off on.
One to finish on. I'll try and make it a good one. That's all right. All right. Well, let's try this one. You can only lead a simple life if you remember what life is really for. The purpose of simplicity is not to let the business of living get in the way of the things that are of importance. Shall I read that again?
Mm-hmm. Read that again, please.
You can only lead a simple life if you remember what life is really for. The purpose of simplicity is not to let the business of living get in the way of the things that are of importance.
That reminds me of that other quote.
You read one now.
No.
Oh, right.
Of that I mentioned to you recently. Of that other Japanese author.
Yes, what was that?
That was Akutagawa Ryunosuke. He's a Japanese author.
Yeah. What did he say?
He said something along the lines, I don't have the direct quote, but he said, he said something like, well, life itself is boring, but you have to... The goal of life is to sort of reinterpret it, you know, just like a piece of wood itself is boring, but in order to make it a beautiful piece of art, you have to kind of craft it and you have to reinvent it and reinterpret what wood means. So in the same way, you have to kind of, because life itself is a bit, well, life on its own is just a bit useless, isn't it? I mean, it's just a bit, well, you can do anything with it. Mm. Like, it's so open that you could just sit there and just kind of eat and sleep and have sex and that's kind of it. Like, your basic urges are being kind of met.
Yep.
But then, is that particularly holy thing? I'm not sure. But
well, even interesting, what I was curious, when you told me that the other week, I found that a really inspiring quote because everyone's different and people have different resonances, say, with different words, but for example, I've never really resonated with this whole business of meaning. When people say, oh no, there is meaning in life, you know, fulfill your potential, blah blah, for me it does nothing. But in a way, if I hear something like, well, life isn't particularly interesting unless you make it really interesting, and for me that just rings true. I'm like, in a way, that's what I'm doing. It's, I feel like, with my life, it's like, yeah, you can play as many computer games as you want, and you can drink, and you do anything you want. It's fine. But for me, it's just like, is this it?
Is this it?
And then on the other side, I think on a lived experience, you can make it interesting. Your friendships can become interesting. You talk about interesting things. Meditation's interesting. So, I'm shaping my life in a way that's like an adventure now. It's sort of open-ended. That's all I really ask for, really, which is a tall order in this world. But I'm lucky enough to, you know, to do that. But I think, just the way it's phrased, I found really helpful. Like, actually, because you get this feeling sometimes, it's like, it's not particularly interesting.
No.
I'm just sitting here, mildly, slightly negative.
On its own, it's a bit,
just having a cup of tea, looking out the window. It's like, so what? What is that?
Could actually be possibly worse. In other parts of the world, you know,
of course.
Like, you're lucky, but
but still.
But what do you do with that kind of freedom? What do you do with that? I'm hesitant to call it privilege, but what do you do with that kind of that you actually have time on your hand?
Just to make life interesting.
On that note.
On that note.
Make your life interesting, people.
Let's all
shape
make
it
our life
like a raw piece
shape
of wood like a, yeah. into a beautiful statue.
Exactly. Your life is a beautiful statue.
Yeah. Well, not yet, but...
No, but it will be.
It will be.
Yeah. Good. Great. Oh, well, that was good.
It was nice.
Yeah, we won't even have to edit this.
No.
Brilliant. We can just put it
that's
out there.
That's a new. That's a first.
Lord. And we're smiling and not smiling, feeling like
happy, unclenched.
Take some heroin afterwards to calm down. We did really well. Fantastic.
Good. Right. Well,
thanks
be
for
well.
That.
Thanks for that.
Be well, everyone. Ciao.